I'd like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Mary Ellen from Santee.
Oh my God.
Hi, my name is Mary Ellen, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. Welcome to the newcomers, the old timers, and everybody in between, and especially the guy from Minnesota. It's nice to be represented from everywhere. So, I'm really nervous. I don't normally get nervous, but unless I'm going to tell the truth. So I guess I'll have to do a little bit of that tonight. We were driving over here, and I was thinking, I used to live in San Carlos on Boulder Lake and Wren Crib, and I went to Gage and Pershing and Patrick Henry and ran amok in the streets of Allied Gardens and La Mesa, and it was really kind of weird just going, oh, yeah, I remember that house. Oh, I remember that street. Oh, yeah, I remember. Yeah, never mind. I don't want to remember that. But, that whole, my whole drinking career, my whole alcoholic behavior started like, I don't know, when I was born. I popped out of my mom's womb, and it was just kind of like, okay, I'm here, and you're going to give me all the attention I want for the rest of my life. And I was kind of demanding and selfish, self-centered, egotistical, and all the things that that book talks about. You know, and I hadn't even had a drink yet. We lived in a small town in Minnesota. My dad was the coach and the history teacher in the high school. And then we moved from that small town of 800 people to like a little bigger town of 1,400 people. And he was the coach. And then my sister was born. And then we moved from the 1,200 people to Edina, St. Louis Park. And then my other sister was born, and she's absolutely wonderful. She was born in 1964, and I was born in 1958, and in 1965 when she was 1 year old, and I was whatever that is, I think I was six, seven, I started the bathtub. And my grandmother needed the channel changed out in the living room, so I went out and I changed the channel, and my sister fell into the tub. And I was only six, and I could only reach the hot water. And so she was burned over three-quarters of her body, first, second, and third degree, and staph infection. And she was in the hospital for 3 months, and that was the first time of many, many hospital visits. And the first thing to go on my list of, God, are you a fuck-up, you know, and the stuff that if nothing else worked when I was drinking, I could pull that list out and go, poor me, and I could really get you to pour me a lot of drinks. After that, she was the last one that was born. My mom had 12 kids and five of us lived. And thank God, I would have killed the rest of them anyway. So We moved from there. We moved from St. Louis Park to Edina, and that was my very favorite house in the whole world. It kind of had five bedrooms, and it had a family room, and a dining room, and a living room, and an entry room, and a yard. I mean, really, a yard. You know, those are the things that are big with grass, and they don't have those a lot out here. And God, I love that house. And I remember one day I had two older brothers from my mom's first marriage, and actually her first two. She married the same guy twice. And it's a family thing. And they went golfing one day, and they're coming home, and they're like, whoa, look, there's a fire truck. Let's follow it. You know, Dad, look, it's turning down into our neighborhood. Cool, let's follow it. Dad, look, it's turning down our street. Cool, let's follow it. Dad, that's our house. I had decided I wanted to make a chocolate dip cone, and back then, you know, Hershey came in, they had a paper wrapping around the Hershey can, and it caught on fire, and it flew into the curtains, and the kitchen caught on fire, and I tried to put the fire out, and I got slapped and sent out of the house. But that was another thing that I could put on my little list of, what a moron. And, we left there when I was 11 years old, and we moved out to California, over to that house. That was the first house that we actually stayed in for any period of time because we moved a lot. And my dad wasn't in the military. We just moved a lot. When my sister was born, Elizabeth, my youngest one, my mom developed postpartum depression. And back in 1964, they didn't know how to deal with that. So what they did is they gave her shock treatment, and they gave her every kind of medication you could think of, and they put her in and out of the hospital. And she did that from 1964 to 1979. When we moved out here, part of the reason we moved out here was because, like, well, maybe the California sunshine would help Mom. And it did not. But when we moved out here, I was short. I was fat. I talked like I was from Minnesota. If you've ever seen the movie Fargo, they had nothing on me. And I hated myself and everybody around me, and I knew that I was different. And I was going to prove just how different I was. The first couple weeks I was here, I was sitting in front of some guy in class, and he said something to me, so I jammed a pencil into his kneecap. And he still has that in his kneecap, by the way. And coincidentally, several years later, he turned out to be one of my best friends. There was three of them, and we hung out together. Two of them have died since. One of them was the man who was killed by the police downtown because he had a stick, and he was brandishing a stick at the police, and they shot him. And then his brother, he got mad at the cops for shooting his brother, and then they shot him. And I was like, oh, God. But these are the people I grew up with, and this is like, this was normal for our life. You know, I never knew that my life was dysfunctional because my neighborhood was dysfunctional. I mean, everything we did, everybody did. You know, my mom was in a mental institution off and on. She didn't know who we were. She used to think that she was Tinkerbell and other things, and she would give away all the stuff in the house, you know. And we would have to follow her and go, hey, you know, that picture my mom gave you, yeah, it's not anybody you know. We'll take it back. And it was great. It was wonderful. You know, we'd go to the hospital, and she'd go, God, you're such beautiful little kids. Who are you? And we'd go, we're yours. And she'd go, oh, okay. And, you know, so that's just another thing to put on that list of poor me, poor me, poor me, another frickin' drink. You know, so then it's funny. I was talking to some of the girls on the way over here, and we were talking about, I'm sorry if anybody's going to be offended by this word, but we were talking about when we were virgins. And they were saying, yeah, I was a virgin until, and I was a virgin until, and I said, and I wanted to be. And but coincidentally, that person who I jammed the pencil into his kneecap and two other friends of mine at the time, they were my best friends. And we hung out together 24/7. We hung out at the ramp. We smoked pot. We drank our parents' beer. We talked big, and I gave them all hickeys. And then I was a real winner. And then we had a couple of female friends who hung out with us, too. And one day they decided that I didn't need to be a virgin anymore. So they locked me in the bedroom, and I was molested by my three best friends. And the two women who were my two female best friends held the door, so that would continue to happen. And, you know, I kept hanging out with them. I did, because I didn't know any better. I didn't know any different. I thought, you know, I must have done something, because I come from a time, you know, if a woman got raped or if she got something happened to her, she must have done something wrong, you know. And I was sure that I was just supposed to keep hanging out with them. And, oh, something else to put on the list. Oh, it's great. I loved my list, by the way. And after that happened, you know, that kind of takes the specialness out of being the virgin away. So I just said, fuck it, and him and it and whatever. And I started changing, though. You know, the anger became mean. And, you know, I talk about my baby sister who got burned, and I have protected her whole life. I love her unconditionally. And then there's the other sister who I love her very much. She I do love her, but we have a very strained relationship, and it's difficult when somebody is always telling you how you should feel about them and what you should do for them, and you know what they're going to do for me, and how come I'm not grateful enough, and blah blah blah. And it's like, you know, I love you, and do it because you want to do it, you know. So when I was in high school, I got kicked out of junior high school quite a few times because I was a little angry. I remember one day the teacher was doing the math and, you know, he's using his middle finger. He's all, you know, one and one is two. It's a junior high school. And he said, so do you know the answer? And I just said, fuck you too. And so he said, you need to go to the office. And I was like, okay, I don't really care. I knew everybody by first name basis. And I went in there and, hi, Earl, that was my counselor. And he said, why are you here? And I said, because I really love the color of that referral. It's just the most beautiful shade of pink. Oh, and here you go. And what happened is my dad owned Here Comes Money Fundraising. And what he would do is he would go to all the schools all the time. And he knew all these people almost as well as I did. And he happened to be in the office one day, and he's like, oh, my God, why are you here again? Why not, you know? Same thing's going to happen when I get home. I remember running away from home when I was 16. I had no reason to run away. But somebody said, hey, let's run away. Okay. So I packed up all my belongings, and we went to Long Beach. I don't know why. So my dad drove up to Long Beach and got me. And my friend and her mother. And, God, that was not a good drive home. In any way, shape, or form, I was grounded for life, and which I was done several times in my life. And part of the reason I had moved back to La Mesa about 12 years ago so I could fulfill that for my father. And I now live in Santee, thank God. And, you know, oh, I lost my train of thought. That's horrible. It's just an indication of my age. I was in junior high school. Oh, I got kicked out of junior high school, and I fought a lot. You know, people would look at me, and I didn't like that, and or they wouldn't look at me, and I didn't like that. And, you know, they would breathe, and I didn't like that. So I'd get in these fights, and I remember bashing this woman's head into a toilet and just going, you know, why do you exist? And, they kicked me out of junior high school for that. I just, you know, but my dad came in and he smoothed it out. There's a pattern here. You'll hear it in a second. And then I moved on to high school. And by that time I was smoking pot and I was drinking. And for my 16th birthday, they came out with boxes of wine. And my dad was so excited to give me a box of wine to put in the refrigerator. And that stuff was nasty. But he thought if he bought me the booze at home, and he didn't know that I drank tequila and rum. He thought I just drank wine. And hey, Dad, could you pick me up a, you know, carton of cigarettes? And a... Anyway, so he thought, well, if I have the alcohol at home and I have the cigarettes at home and I have the stuff at home, she'll want to stay at home and she won't follow the path of, you know, the rest of the family. And what that did, that's kind of like, you know, got me ready to go out and party. You know, I like to party. I didn't like to party at home. I like to come home at the end of a week or two and drink the NyQuil so I could take a nap. But, you know, and I always told my dad, Dad, I think I have an ulcer. And, you know, he always made sure there was Bromo for my tummy. And I had trouble sleeping, so there was always NyQuil so I could sleep. And, you know, my dad was just incredibly codependent. And enabling, that's the word that I recently have learned. And I love my dad. Anyway, I was kicked out of day school, Patrick Henry Day School, and they kicked out again. Then I went to night school, and I was kicked out, and I was kicked out again. And they said, because I was supplying the whole school with alcohol, and I was like, you know, I'm not even 21. I can't even buy this stuff, you know. Okay, yeah, I can steal it, and I can do this, and I can do that, and all my friends are drunk, and there are bottles in my car, and, you know, whatever. And so I got kicked out of school, and I never thought I had a problem because I had a girlfriend who drank perfume to cover up the smell of alcohol. I didn't drink perfume. I didn't have a problem. Talk about not keeping a job. I hadn't even gotten to that point yet. I couldn't stay in school. I couldn't, you know, I couldn't do anything coherently. And I just didn't want to be. I just wanted to escape. And so I found every way I could, I come from the 70s, and we partied. We had crosstops, we had Quaaludes, we had rum, We didn't have all the fancy rums now, though. We just had 151. Straight out of the bottle. Kick it back. Man, take a swig off the squirt just in case. Yeah, that was good stuff. And then I got kicked out of school, and gosh, what am I going to do with my life? Oh, I know, I'll get pregnant. So I did. And I moved out of my dad's house. Well, okay, what happened is I broke up with this guy. It's another pattern in my life. And I broke up with him, and he shot himself. And, oh, no. He went to shoot himself in the head, and it didn't work, so he went like this, and he shot himself in the wrong head. And he still has that bullet in his ass. There is a God. And so I had to, and then he moved into my house because his family wouldn't let him move back home. And I couldn't figure out why your son, you know, he tried to kill himself. Why wouldn't you let him come home? And my dad said, oh, he can stay with us. And I got pregnant. And then he said, it's not mine. I go, of course it's not. Isn't that the old story? And then I moved out and I got on welfare. That was the bomb. 18 years old on welfare. Just frickin' big, walking through the streets. I quit drinking long enough to have the baby until he was 2 weeks late and somebody brought me over a little thing of brandy and said, this will help. And I went, okay. And I went into labor. And 18 hours of incredibly horribleness. And this little Catholic doctor came in and he was so sweet and so cute. And if you've ever seen The Exorcist and Harry and just all those movies, that was me because I was really surprised by what happened with my body. And but, you know, I'm a trooper. And I took him home and started drinking about noon. And I kept him for 4 months. And I have for the 30 years of my sobriety flippantly said, well, who can do a line, drop a lid, and take a drink and change a diaper? It's freaking, it gets in the way, you know? The truth of the matter is that I couldn't take care of myself. There is no way that I could. I found a picture the other day, and I'm holding this baby, and I'm just petrified. You can see that I was scared to death. So for my 19th birthday, I put him up for adoption. And I have not had any contact with him, nor do I believe it is my right to do that. And I hope that he has had an incredibly much better life than I could have given him at that time. A year after that, I had another boyfriend. And he died of a heroin overdose. And I was like, oh, my God, he died. I bet you he's done with this. I want to go where he went. So I did more drugs with my alcohol because alcohol was always in the picture. And I didn't go where he went. I just got really wasted and found a whole lot more ways to do it. And then my dad said, hey, I want you to go see the doctor your mom sees. Why? He's never really done her any good, but okay. Except that she did have these really good pills, you know. And she'd say, I don't want you to have to get your drugs on the street, so I want you to just go ahead and take the ones that I got. Okay, I can do that for you, Mom. Not a problem. So I went in to see this doctor, and he said to me, do you think it's normal to be carving up your legs with a razor blade? And do you think it's normal to in your... Does everybody hear that?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank God. So, do you think it's normal to do the things you do? And I'm like, yeah, everybody I know does it, you know. And he said, well, it's not. And I was like, oh. So I said, well, are we done here? And he goes, yeah, you can go. And he goes, but we have some place for you to go. And I was like, oh, crap. So my dad said, oh, I feel so bad about this. Let's go buy you some clothes at Target. Okay. Let's go shopping. And I spent the next 6 weeks on the best drugs and the best high I had ever been on in my life. And then I left. And but I spent time in these meetings in there. They kept sending me to these meetings with these people, and they were talking in circles, and they were talking about life. And I just wanted to make a wallet and a belt and go home. And my brother used to like to make the book covers, but didn't do that. So I ended up going home, and it was a fun little stint. And so, but that got to be something else on my list. So I have been to institutions and jails. I've been raped. I've been drunk. I've been kicked out of school. So shortly after that, I thought, well, gosh, my life is so boring right now. What should I do? So I fell in love again. Oh, it was awesome. He was way older than I was, and he was an incredible drunk. And he liked to go to the bars. I went to, you know, the Trojan Horse, the Horseshoe, the Magic Lounge. You know, all the high places in California, San Diego. And he took me up to Long Beach. That was fun. That was great. The last time I saw him, we were at, it was called a Goat Festival. And if you men know what that is. You know, you got this little thing and all the drunks in the bar, they called it the goat whatever bar. And we all went, we had this festival, and all these great big people came in with chains and bats and attacked us. And it's the first time I ever and last time I ever did acid. And I'll tell you, because I'm sure that's what made everything happen was the acid. And that night he dove into a pool and broke his neck and died. And yeah, I know. Isn't it awesome? No, but I'm not killing him. I'm going to tell you that right now. I'm not killing him. Drugs, alcohol, the lifestyle, going out there, doing what they wanted to do on their own, that's what was killing him. Ray wanted to quit drinking. He, in fact, he took a couple days off and stayed home. And I was like, I'll be back to check on you. And I didn't come back. The night he died, I called my dad and I said, oh, Dad, Ray died. And he came up and he got me in Long Beach and he brought me home. And I jumped on a bus and went back to Long Beach. And decided that I needed to be a bartender in a beer and wine place that had a rebel flag and a bunch of bikers and a bunch of I have no idea. And that's not an indication of you people. I'm not segregating you. So what happened is the flag got stolen one night while I was bartending because I had a tendency to drink a little too much while I was tending bar. And the owner of the bar came in, I started chucking glasses at him. He's like, why are you in this bar? And he told me I had to go get the flag, and I did, whatever was necessary for a very young, sweet young girl to go into the group of mongrels and get something back that didn't belong to them. And then I felt so bad that this guy said, hey, let's get married. I said, okay, why not? I look good in these pants, and I'm wearing a see-through black shirt. Let's do it. And so I guess we got married, so I'm told. And I called my mom, and I said, and this was her favorite story, I got to tell you. I called my mom and said, hey, I just got married. She said, what's your last name? I said, I don't know. I'll check. Do you know what's sad about that? Is my whole life is now a country western song, and I listen to country music. So every day I just get to go, oh, yeah, I remember that. And so anyway, I left him high and dry up there in Long Beach. I went and talked to the little man who married us and said, you told, they say your thing, I don't want to be married to this guy who I was watching him go up and down the street with his laundry basket for 2 days. And so I came back down to San Diego, and he came after me. And luckily, he came into the Trojan Horse to get me, and for some reason or other, I knew every man in the bar, and he left and never came back. And that was good. So that was in August of 1980. In July of 1980, my mom came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. In 1978, she told the doctors to go screw. She said, you know what? They were going to put her in a little room, little 6x8 room for the rest of her life with a metal bed. And she said, no, this isn't going to happen. And her alcoholism kicked in. Like, okay, I'm not getting shock treatment, but this looks good. And we used to hang out at the Navajo Inn, and we would, we partied. My mom and I, she, you know, because she was still getting the pills, but... So what happened is in July 1980, she came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And from July 1980 to April 1981, I continued to drink. And I would call her, got married, Mom. I'm coming to see you, Mom. And she'd go, okay. You know, and about 2 days before I got there, my hair would show up. The next day, my eyes and my breath. You know, and then she'd open the door and go, oh, you're here, finally. And she'd invite me in, and she was just so unconditionally loving that it didn't matter. She just wanted to love me as her daughter. And I'd go, God, Mom, how could you not want this life? This is so fun. I'm just having a blast out there. I remember that a friend of mine went to jail up there, and I said, you know what? I have money in a bank in San Diego. I'm going to go get it. My uncle died, and he left it to me. And I went to this bank, and I made a scene, and I screamed, and I yelled, and I called my dad, and he said, well, he's not dead. What are you talking about, you know? That was kind of like the day I was watching TV and I was laughing my ass off, and he came in and he said, what are you doing? And I said, this is the funniest show. And he goes, wouldn't it be funnier if you turned the TV on? Yeah. But the plants wouldn't be melting so well in the corner. And so between July of 1980 and April of 1981, I turned 21 whenever I turned 21, and I had had a fake ID since I was 17, so I'd been in and out of bars, and I had a lot of fun. But, you know, when you have the actual ID that has your picture on it, see, it's me, it's not this person, and but that person I really owed a huge amends to, because I used to get speeding tickets with her stuff. And other stuff. So that was not easy to do. And but when I had my own picture and my own 21-year-old age, and I'd go into the bars, and I was so incredibly out of control, and I didn't care. I just didn't care. And I would drink whatever I could, and I would take whatever I could, and I would do whatever I could, and I would let be done to me whatever needed to be done so that I could just go away. I have been locked in rooms and beaten and raped. I have been left in streets. I have, you know, I've just had all this stuff that you think, oh, that poor woman. And I'm like so grateful to have had all this stuff, you know. I came into the rooms and I was really angry. You know, I used to get in fights and I'd hit people and they'd drop and I'd keep hitting the wall. I didn't care. You know, I went into Turning Point April of 1981, and for the first 6 months I was there, when I would come in, everybody would leave. And I went down to breakfast one morning, and someone asked me how I was doing, and I threw a knife at her. It's none of your fucking business, you know. And I thought if I stayed angry and stayed that way, you would stay away from me. Problem is, there was this manager there, and she said, you know, no matter what you do, we're not going to kick you out. I was like, really? I never did vacuum that house the whole time I was there. Well, you know that. I took the whole yard and turned it over. I got sent back to the dorm like 5 times. I was grounded, I don't know, every third weekend. I had all my stuff taken away. But the fact of the matter is, I slept with a Bible and a big book at night, because I wanted to make sure I was going to be found. I didn't know by who. I didn't know by what. But I wanted to be found. But you weren't going to know it. I was going to kick all your butts. What happened that first year is they said, no matter what you do, we're not going to kick you out. And it was like, I think I was about 8 years sober. And I went, you know, I could have left any time. I didn't have to wait to be kicked out. I mean, that's like, I didn't know I was sober for the first 9 months. I mean, I was walking down the street one day, and somebody, I was whining, because I had a tendency to do that. And I said, I just wish I could get sober. And she's like, Mary, you got 9 months. And I was like, oh, my God, I do, don't I? So to celebrate, I went up to the merry-go-round at Belleville Park and got kicked off. Sober. We were just having fun. Sober fun. I was going to dances. You know, I went back to school and I got my GED. And I remember the day that the thing came in, I was so sure that I was going to fail, because, you know, I had this list of failure. And I'm sitting on the bottom stairs, and I'm there and I'm holding this envelope, and I open it up, and I didn't even know I had that kind of scream inside of me, that kind of joy, that just like, oh, my God. I mean, I'm not a high school graduate, but I'm a GED, you know, and I'm an equivalent. So, you know, so what happened is I went back to cosmetology school, because I had been there several times before, and just couldn't finish. The first time I got pregnant, and that was actually with the first my first son, how I discovered I was pregnant is I was doing a perm and my stomach didn't work on this poor woman. Sorry. And anyway, I went to cosmetology school, and when I got sober, I had problems with my hands, and I drooled a little. And I was shampooing this lady's hair one day, and I just drooled right on her forehead. Oh. And she's like, whoa. And I'm like, hey, honey, you know, it's really good for your hair. Don't worry about it. Yeah. But, you know, I don't drool today much. And so then I got my cosmetology license, and I did hair for quite a while. But I have to go back and tell one other thing. The last night that I drank, and this goes back to my dad always being there for me. You know, he was my champion. He rescued me. I used to beat the boys up, which really explains why a lot happened later. But I used to beat them up, and my dad would go to their doors and go, your son beat my daughter up. And I'm back in the bushes just laughing my ass off. And they're like, no, it was your daughter. And he'd go, no, not my daughter. You know? He would see me in the principal's office. Why are you here? He knew why I was there. I was a brat, you know. The last night I drank was Rhea died in August 18th, and I'd had the marriage, and I'd had all the other stuff, and I was at the Trojan Horse, and I remember I took this drink, and I remember every particle of my body that it touched, and I remember the calm that came over my body. And I remember going, yeah, that's all right. And then I was scared like I hadn't been scared in a long time. And so I had to have more. And then what I could only perceive is the front line of the Chargers came in through the door, and I told them all what I thought of them and that they needed to not be in that bar and they needed to go. You need to go. And they're like, oh, you're so cute, you know. And I'm like, no, I'm really not. And again, it was a good thing I knew all the bikers in the bar, because they just put me aside, and then they took care of that, and, you know, then they asked me to leave the bar. Nobody ever was asked to leave the Trojan Horse, but I was. Go figure. So anyway, I hitchhiked home, which is what I did a lot. Earlier in my drinking, my dad used to drive me to the bars, and he'd give me $5 because he didn't want me to have to, you know, stress. But he wouldn't pick me up, and I'd hitchhike home, and I'd not come home, and I whatever. So this last night, I got home, and I went into the house, and I was in a blackout, and I told my dad to stop loving me, because he was killing me. I said, dude, you're just killing me. And I pulled a knife out, and I broke all the windows in the back bedroom, and called my mom, and said, I can't do this anymore, and came out of my blackout making macaroni and cheese in the kitchen. Love macaroni and cheese today, still. Obviously. And so what happened is then I moved into Turning Point, and when I left Turning Point, the manager at that time had become my sponsor, and I moved into her house, and we kind of took each other hostage for about a year. And I was in and out of relationships, and I had met some people who are in this room back then. And one person told me, he says, you're not the marrying kind. I said, well... Okay. So I had to prove I was, so I got married 3 times in sobriety, and I discovered I'm not the marrying kind. I don't like being told what to do and how to do it and blah, blah, blah. So I have been married and divorced 3 times in sobriety. My last husband, he's the father of my children. I have 2 boys. They are 19 and 21. They have never seen me drink. I cannot say the same for them. In fact, just last night, we were having a little talk about this, and, but anyway, I've been married, I've been divorced, I have, buried many friends and many family members. In, 1994, my brother Paul went to pick his daughter up for visitation, and he was going over a train track in Minnesota, and he was hit by the train, and him and his daughter were killed. And, he had 6 months sobriety at that time. 53 days later, the father of my children was found dead in his van. He had drank himself to death, and he was so drunk, he started coughing and couldn't sit up, and his veins broke, and he drowned in his own blood. And in the next year and a half after that, my psychiatrist, the bastard, died. Because who are you going to go talk to when people start dying, okay? And then my grandmother passed away, and then my mother. She passed away on Christmas Eve, 1996, and she had 14 and a half years sobriety. It's not awesome. They were gonna take her life away. They were gonna lock her up. You know, she didn't know who I was when I was little. She was my best friend when she died. You know, but there again, who do you talk to? So I had a little mental vacation after all of those people went away, and I had my two small boys, and man, I was so freaking lost. And I had the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was about 14 years sober, and though I'd had all this stuff, and I'd lived with my sponsor, you'd think, oh, she lived with her sponsor. She must have got some good program. No. I'd had several sponsors, actually. My first one came up to me and said, I'm going to be your sponsor. I go, oh, whatever that is, okay. She came back 2 weeks later, and she says, I can't sponsor you. Your anger is going to get me drunk. And I'm like, I don't know a lot, but I know that's not going to happen because of me. And then I had another one who said, I'm going to be your sponsor, and then I never saw her again. And then I moved in with Colleen and Gail and their kids, and she remained my sponsor for quite a while, but then she went on with her life and left California, and then I've just had a myriad of sponsors. And I've had some that have shared all of my information at the podium. I've had one that shared the vast du jour, some intimate details about my life, and he went and shared it with the Monday Night Poker group, and then all of their wives called me and said, is this true? I was like, oh, God, yes, it is. It was fun, though. And, you know, so those trust issues that I came in with, or lack of trust issues that I came in with, stayed for a really long time. But after my mom died and I was a little out there, I was really mad at my mom. You know, I was mad. And I beat the crap out of my children once, each of them once. And I felt so bad. And that's where we came up with 1, 2, 3 in my house. And I always said, you never want me to get to three again. And they remembered that until they were old enough and I couldn't pull them apart anymore and the dynamics changed in my house. And they'd go, one mom, two mom. So, anyway, that's neither here nor there. It's like the favorite thing that one of the favorite things that's happened in my sobriety is that after that happened and I realized that I was in a lot of trouble, and it was past the point where when Stan was still alive and the boys were babies, and he couldn't quit drinking, and he sold all the furniture, and he took the car and went to Vegas and took all the money, and he did all this stuff, and I still let him come home because, you know what? I understand the alcoholic. I'm an enabler. And I was going to kill myself and my kids. You know, fuck it. I don't want them to have to go through this. I don't want to have to continue to go through this. And I made a phone call, and they said, you don't have to go through this. I was sober. I hadn't had a drink in 14 years. I hadn't thought of having a drink in 14 years. I had thought of killing myself, killing my children. Never thought about killing him. But he did it on his own, so I didn't have to. The last conversation I had with Stan, he called and said, what do you want from me? And I said, I want you to go away and leave us alone forever. And that's what he did. And then I was angry because that was the first time he listened to me in 5 years. And but my kids didn't have to go through that, you know. I grew up in an alcoholic family. I grew up with all my relatives drank. I had an aunt who, she would wake up on Saturday morning, she would be the biggest bitch you ever met, and she'd go downstairs and do laundry and come back, and she would be so happy. She'd be giddy. She'd be laughing. And I go, wow, what's up with that? One day I'm walking down the stairs into the basement, and I go, what are all these little bottles? You know, and I realized what all those little bottles were, and they just kept replacing them, filling them back up with the booze that she loved to drink. I looked out the kitchen window one day, and she's in the back seat of the car, just kicking it, you know, just kicking the back. And I was, oh, that's how you do it. That's where I learned how to drink. Take it out of the bottle. And anyway, so I'm at home, and my mom's been dead a while. She passed away on Christmas Eve. And that was not easy for a very long time. Today it's a very joyous experience for me. But I was going up the stairs, and I was mad at her, and I kicked the stairs, and I said, what do you think of that, Mom? You know, because, you know, she's dead, so I can talk to her now anytime I want. And something fell off the wall in the kitchen. And when we moved out here in 1969, my brother Paul had a friend named Tom who did macrame, and he macrame'd this thing for our house, and it was beautiful, and it hung in our kitchen from the time we lived out here, and then my mom passed away, and then it went to me. And so I was mad because something fell off the wall, and I'm stomping down the stairs, and I pick it up, and I turn it over, and it says, keep the faith. And that was my mom's answer, keep the faith, you know. And that was a turning point for me in my sobriety at 14 years sober. I didn't have to try to fix the outsides anymore. I didn't have to get married. I didn't have to have expensive cars. I didn't have to have expensive dogs. I didn't have to have matching outfits on my kids, and they were so grateful. And little bowl cuts and matching outfits. Fuck, what is wrong with you, woman? And, you know, I dropped to my knees and I said, God, what do you want from me? And he said, get out of your way. That's all I had to do. So I had to get out of my own way. You know, I had been so sure that I knew how to do it. I knew the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I could tell you where everything was. I could tell you what page, how many times the word sober was in it. You know, I could tell you anything. I couldn't show you a damn thing except how to be really angry, really bitter, you know, really ugly. And what happened is I took a look at these things, these 12 steps, and they're really quite awesome if you really take a moment to think about it. You know, 76 years ago, as an alcoholic, what I had was streets, jails, institutions, real ugly death. But as a recovering alcoholic today, I have 12 suggestions. And the first one is that I admit I am powerless over alcohol. I am way powerless over alcohol. And when the alcohol is not in my life, I'm still way powerless over everything. You know, the alcohol is gone and the ism, it remains. And my ism is I seek more. I seek more of whatever I can get. Misery, happiness, I like to wallow in all of it. You know, and so my life is unmanageable, and what do I do about that? I had to come to believe in a power greater than myself. Well, I got to tell you, you know, I come from Minnesota, and, you know, we have the Jesus loves you theory of the Lutherans, and that's the way I was raised, and that is what I believe today, that is the way I was raised. And, you know, and the thing that I learned when that picture fell off the wall is it's faith. And, you know, in my sobriety, I have thrown tarot cards and thrown runes and, you know, counted ladybugs on leaves and just done all this stuff thinking, you know, okay, this is where I'm going to find my God. And what I ended up finding out by reading the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, because it actually says in there that's what this book is here for, is to help you find a power greater than yourself, is I went back to find out that my higher power was within me. And that my connection is direct, and that I am never without God's grace, ever. You know, my life, trust me, I can hit frappe that quick, and my life is all over the place. And God just watches. Yeah, I remember I used to go to Pathfinders, and I was talking one day, and I said, you know what? God looks at me as if I'm E.F. Hutton. And he says, shh. Mary Ellen's going to talk now. And actually what he's doing was going, come here. Come here, she's going to say it again. She's so funny. She really thinks she's in charge. It's just the cutest thing to watch. Guess what? I was not in charge, and I am not in charge today. And I have lots of character defects and lots of flaws, but those are in different steps. So I turn my will, my life over the care of God as I understand them on a daily basis, as I understand them. That's another thing the book says. You don't have to believe in my God. I don't have to believe in your God, your higher power, your spirit, your whatever it is that helps you stay clean and sober on a daily basis. That's your personal decision. That's your personal connection, as is mine, you know. And I have a very loving and generous God who... I was telling somebody today, God does for me what I can't do for myself, especially when he sees that I'm stuck, you know, and it's a pretty cool thing. And I have, the step four was really easy for me because my favorite thing to talk about is me, and I was willing to do a fifth step with anybody who would listen. I would go to, you know, the grocery store and go, hi, you know what, I'm an AA. Oh, really? Okay. You know, and I have never, ever been embarrassed to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everybody knew when I was a drunk. Everybody knew when I was a drunk. Everybody knows when I'm sober. Everybody knows when I'm nuts. So I after the 14 years, I actually did it the correct way. I didn't do the fictional story of my life, you know, where I'm the star and thank you for coming to the academy. I actually did the columns and the resentments and all the stuff that goes with that, and looked at the fear, and I'm a fear-based person. I live in fear, kind of like it. It's a little adrenaline rush. And then I had to go back and look at that list again and realize that all these people that wronged me, all these fingers I pointed at these people, it wasn't them. It was me. You know, I am the epitome of an alcoholic. I will set the stage. I will poke the buttons. I will want everything to be the way I want it. And I hurt people still to this day because of that. You know, the character defects, I can fall prey to jealousy, anger, discontent. I recently went through some of that. And it's a hard lesson to learn, and it's a hard lesson to love people and to let people love you unconditionally. But I'm so grateful that we have these steps so that we can do that, and made that list. Again, you refer back to that four-step list. I was like, damn it. And had to make those amends. Yeah, sorry for your driver's license being suspended for the rest of your life. And how much do I owe you? And, when my dad was sleeping, I sold his furniture. And wrecked his car, emptied his business account, took all his silver from under his bed, and I went to make amends to him, and I said, you know, Dad, I haven't been, like, the best daughter. He goes, no, you're okay. What are you comparing me to? And he said, just don't drink, and you don't ever have to pay me any of that back. But it took him 9 years to give me a key to his house. I was really thrilled. I thought that was cool. But then he sold it, like within a month. So I don't know. I continue to take my personal inventory on a daily basis. There's nobody harder on me than me. I have gotten to so many plateaus in my sobriety, and I have gotten to so many places that I said, I want to get there. And when I get there, it's not enough. There's never enough. You know, I like all the good stuff that comes in my life. I like all the lessons. If there were no lessons to learn, I wouldn't learn any lessons. And